Yes, sir. I am. Like, it was at 6 o'clock this morning, mate, so I can't believe you cannot have it.
Thank you. Mr. Matheson and Mr. Thompson, it may well be that we should follow with you now in relation, at least in part, to matters of Grafton Gates and also other matters in terms of your closing. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe actually I'll start, if I may, with the document that I was handed up this morning.
Yes.
I'm just trying to move. Thank you. So I just wanted to start, I guess, by saying that the comments that were made this morning weren't intended to be unduly pedantic, but my clients are keen to avoid a case of buyer's remorse. So it's better to raise it now, I guess, than not. The first point on arable farming, and I've just had a conversation with my friend Mr. Conway, and he may be able to update the court, but it wasn't immediately clear to me that Rule 4.1, so the first permitted activity rule, imposed a 20 hectare limit on arable farm, and that was the upshot of Mr. Conway's response. The implication is that if it does impose a limit of 20 hectares on arable farming, any arable farming on a property greater than 20 hectares would be a controlled activity. Now, I understand from Mr. Conway, who can address you, is that that may not have actually been the intent after all. And so that does seem that that needs to get addressed. And just turning to Rule 4.1, you'll see there it's got items 1 to 9, and then on item 10 for properties greater than 20 hectares, there's a specific limit for horses or that it's used for free-range poultry. But I didn't read that as being a limit on arable farming. Which is why I came up with my three hypothetical examples. So I guess these two points, one is if the intention is ultimately that there should be a 20 hectare limit on arable farming, should be made clear. that's subject to our broader comment that we say it should be permitted. And I'll just briefly touch on that. The reference in the council's reply legal submissions to Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence, I've just turned to that. So that's at paragraph 184 of Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence. That is in a conclusory, well, it's in paragraph one of the conclusion, and it's one sentence. So that's at paragraph 184, which is referenced in the, so that's the evidence relied on. If I can also just ask, and I didn't put this in my notes, but if I can just ask you to turn to, note paragraph 148 of Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence. And there he says, so this is the only other place that I think he substantively actually addresses cropping. And he says, cropping and horticulture are relatively small in scale and occur mostly in the central Waikato and lower Waikato FMU. So my submission is there's no substantive analysis in Dr. Scarsbrook's evidence that would warrant a controlled activity for all arable cropping in the Waikato, and certainly not in the paragraph reference. I would also submit, Your Honour, that even as a permitted activity, as my clients seek, it's still subject to Schedule C, all of the minimum standards. It's still subject to Schedule D1, farm plans, which themselves have limits on land and soil, cultivation setbacks, slope. So they're already in D1. So my submission, what's the additional benefit one gets from requiring controlled activity consent, which all that requires you to do is go through a D2 farm plan? As opposed to being a permitted activity and applying D1.
As a permitted activity, registration and so on is accepted.
It's all in Schedule D.
But your clients are not protesting about that level of bureaucracy.
No. And I guess to some extent, I guess the other point which I should make in fairness. Is Dr. Lemire, I think, in his evidence, I can't find a reference, but he made the point that although cropping may not seem a very important component, it is often carried out in conjunction with other activities. And so when someone says, what do you do on the farm, and you say dairy or dry soup or whatever, you don't often say, oh, and I also do 40 hectares of arable or 25 hectares. So some of those land use type aggregation of land uses might not actually accurately reflect the degree of cropping activity that happens. So in our submission, arable cropping in the Waikato catchment, bearing in mind, of course, that it's really sediment primarily, possibly a bit of phosphorus, stock exclusions, not an issue for arable cropping, should be a permitted activity subject to a requirement for a D1 farm plan and the Schedule C. If I turn then to... the only other point I guess I'd make on that, and that's, you know, if there are restrictions on more intensive operations, and I'm thinking here dairy and or pastoral farming, it's surely incumbent on the plan to allow an easier route for other farming uses. And to the extent someone might wish to transition from a more nitrogen-intensive activity through in the future through to arable cropping, then that would obviously be an easier road if it were permitted than if one needed a resource consent. So in terms of future flexibility of land uses, that would seem to be an equally important opportunity. Then, just turning to the definition of property, that was a helpful response this morning. And again, The intention really was to make sure that in the circumstances, that, and there were a number of farming witnesses that did explain that for various reasons, including that, you know, transition of farms between different members of the farming family, there might be different arrangements between family trusts, etc., that one didn't get caught in a silly situation where half the farm is still owned by the family trust and that's leased back to a farming company, and then you need to work out what your stocking rate is on one half of the farm and not the other half, because that's leased by you but it's not owned by you. So someone doing the calculation says, well, you can't count that and that together, you've got to assess them separately. That just seems bureaucratic lunacy, which is why we are suggesting that phrase be added, on the property, including the adjacent leased land, or ideally just amend the definition of property. I just do want to make the point there, just in case that's misunderstood. We do understand why the stocking rate and fertiliser use, you shouldn't be able to spread it out over a single operating unit and multiple disaggregated bits of land that are operated together as a single operating unit. So the provisions that were put forward deliberately drew a distinction between the property, including adjacent leased land, and a single operating unit. Because from my client's perspective, they see the logic in being able to assess cumulative effects of animals and or fertiliser application on contiguous or near contiguous pieces of land, as opposed to broader pieces of land operated, albeit operated together. So we say the answer isn't just simply to replace all references to property to single operating unit, because that would create other difficulties. Turning then lastly to the dry stock yards issue and the comment that was raised, and Mr. Conway was asking effectively what the concern is. I guess I can answer this in two ways. One is, helpful that dairy yards are sealed and washed down. The word dairy is added into the legal submissions, which in fairness was in the markup provision, so that's more helpful. I guess that the fundamental concern, though, is the nature of dry stock yards that might only be used once every few months or once every 6 months for a reasonably low intensity use. The implication from the council's legal submissions appeared to be that if at the time the animals were in a yard, a dry stock yard, and defecated, and that wouldn't be appropriate for that to be washed off onto adjacent grass, there would need to be some form of effluent management system put in. And that seems to be the implication of the council's legal submissions, where it says just turning such effluent onto grass would not sufficiently treat it. And that's the fundamental concern, is that someone might read that and say, well, actually, this means now that for all dry stock yards in the Waikato need to have a resource consent or apply for an effluent management system. I'm sure that's not the intention, but that seemed to be. Well, that's certainly enriched and or made. I'm assuming it's not the intention, because it's still limited to dairy yards are sealed and washed down, not other yards. But it was really the reference in the legal submission that caused the concern. And just to be absolutely clear, there's no suggestion that in that scenario it's appropriate to discharge it to water. That's clear. It's simply that in circumstances where there are other rules, and I think Chapter 3 point something in the regional plan on effluent management, and specific controls on dairy yards, that dry stock yards can be in that category. And remembering as well that dry stock yards will be the critical source area, and they'll be managed under the critical source area provisions by certified farm planners, who can look at the dry stock yards in different situations and say, okay, well, are there some that are more risky than others? And for example, if there's some that are nearer water bodies, they might need to take extra steps. So that's really the concern there. And I guess that was the reluctance to have the phrase untreated farm animal effluent. Don't disagree with the intention, it's just how it might be applied. I don't think I really have much more to add unless there's any particular questions. I think the closing submissions, and again, I suppose drawing attention to the opening submissions, the notes that were handed up, and the closing submissions, I think accurately reflect the position that we've reached. And happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Matheson. Mr. Thompson, nothing to add? Thank you. Might be appropriate at this stage to call on the other cattle and sheep farming properties. Ms. Carruthers, I see you there. Is there anything you want to add to your submissions in closing?
Yes, sir, if I may, just some brief comments, primarily touching on the scope matter that's been addressed this morning, and then just some brief comments, if I may, in response to the Council's submission without wanting to get into a tennis match of who gets to go last, etc. In relation to the rural gateways, the three points that I've made in my closing and wish to address is firstly, no party has addressed the scope to change the gateway from all other farming, which captures arable farming, so from all other farming to dairy farming only. So none of the parties, including the council, have addressed that confinement of the rural gateway in their submissions, and I say there's no scope to change the rules in that way. Secondly, in relation to the nitrogen risk scorecard, I maintain the position that there's no scope to introduce that tool as a gateway into Plan Change 1. I addressed in my opening submissions, and it's a paragraph 27A, that the Independent Commissioner specifically rejected the use of the nitrogen risk scorecard as the gateway, and that decision has not been appealed by any of the parties. I've looked at Mr. Minhinnick's submissions drawing on the threads that he says establishes scope, and I disagree with that. I also briefly looked at the beef and lamb appeal while we've been in court this morning that was raised by Commissioner Hodges. But my reading of that appeal is that it does not touch on Schedule B, which is where the calculation of the gateway is done, nor on any of the rules in the plan change. It's limited to a handful of policies and then some other schedules, but not Schedule B. The third issue then in Schedule B is obviously the Ruai decision support tool and the option to use alternative models. No party has established scope to delete that from Plan Change 1. Now, the Council's submissions, as I read it, is that they no longer support the decision's version of Plan Change 1, but there is no appeal seeking to delete those provisions. Now, if, despite all of that, the court looks to include the nitrogen risk scorecard as a gateway, then I consider that the work that the Council is currently doing to consider and compare the results from Overseer versus the NRS is critical before the court goes any further with the nitrogen risk scorecard. Now, I'm not aware of exactly what the Council is doing there, but I would expect that work to both rank the 50 farms under each tool and then to compare the groupings that they each fit within in terms of high, moderate and low. And that work really needs to be done before it can be contemplated at all to use the nitrogen risk scorecard. Now, the fact that work is taking some months to prepare suggests that the tool is not as straightforward as some of the parties have been putting forward to the court. I also want to just touch briefly on Mr. Anderson's point this morning that it's unfair to parties with limited resources to be looking at such a new tool at this point in the process. The point I wish to make is that it's not just confined to parties with limited resources. Wairakei Pastoral still has not been provided its aggregate scores for any of the individual farms on the estate that supply Fonterra. So it's effectively in the dark, despite having resources and extensive involvement in the Change One process. And I think it would be absolutely unfair and unjust, Your Honour, to be looking at introducing it now, when no farmers in the catchment have any understanding of their aggregate score. Yes, they may be familiar with using the scorecard and the various elements that get notified them each year in their insights report, but the aggregate score is a completely new, untried and untested tool that the farmers have got no awareness of. So that's on the gateways matter. Then just four brief points from the council submissions. Firstly, at the paragraph 5.9, the question why Wairakei has put forward an alternative to one of the policies. So the question why we consider it unworkable. I just wanted to clarify that Wairakei had no issue with the council's version of that policy. It put forward some revised wording in an attempt to address Mr. Willis's concern with the workability of the policy with Overseer. So just wanted to clarify that we've got no issue with the council's version of that policy. We were attempting to fix an issue identified by somebody else. Just briefly on the vires of the non-complying rule, and this is paragraph 12.3 of the council's submissions, where they suggest that consent granted under the rule does involve the physical act of changing from one land use to another, and I disagree with that for the reasons I put forward in my opening submissions. It's not a physical act, it's not the new activity, it's not the new land use, it's not the new discharges. And then, as I've said in my opening, there is no scope, at least in the Wairakei appeal, to change the rule in the way suggested. Council's now flagging the OG appeal instead, and I consider there's no scope, in that appeal either, to either hybridise the rule as is now suggested or to turn it into the land use rule itself. And finally, of course, it's not essential, the rule, because we have the NES freshwater, which captures the same change activity. The next point is at 16.8 of the council. This relates to the ability to report, which is clause 16.2 of the first schedule. The council seems to have taken the approach that because clause 16.2 is generally used by the councils with responsibility for the plan, this court should go through a scope finding exercise to bring on those changes. While it is correct that it is generally councils that use 16.2 to fix problems in their plans, it's absolutely open to the court to do so. And then just finally at 18.14, which is the issues that I was raising with the note that the council has now put above the rules. The council considers that protect deity does not assist. I say they've misread the point there, but I wasn't talking about the permitted activities being captured. The note purports to bundle controlled activities and restricted discretionary activities to give the most restrictive activity status across the property for operating unit. And as Your Honour will be aware, Petit Dazier says that that's not the correct approach. So just wanted to be clear that I wasn't focused on the permitted activity component of the note, but actually the RD controlled activity ordering there. So those are the only comments that I wish to make, Your Honour, but obviously if there's any questions from the court in terms of my submission.
Thank you. No, thank you very much for that, Mr. Roberts. Now, next, Is Ms. Torrett on the line? Lockie or Farmlands? No? All right. Mr. Pennell, glad you made it through the traffic. We have read, as I'm sure you understand, we've read the various submissions that have been made. This is an opportunity for you to highlight anything in particular. And if there have been things raised, for example, in the regional council's closing, addressing your matters, a chance for you to highlight anything or explain anything. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and apologies for lateness.
No, quite all right.
I spent a lot of time stopped. If I can start where Mr. Matheson finished, I think, on Schedule D, Clause 8E, I think it is, where Council has made an amendment there.
Yes.
Just further to that, it does worry me that it can be interpreted that effluent from dry slot yards will require consent. I guess untreated is really definitely, in my book, a step too far. After all, how do you treat effluent other than doing a large point source discharge type treatment operation? Dairy effluent is not treated, it's controlled in the way it's applied to the land. I think the main issue or the way to work through this is to recognise that yards are another critical source area and that they should be managed as such. The certifier needs to be checking those out to ensure that there's not concentrated flow discharge paths to water. There's decent grass filtering available. And in fact, Council's own guidelines on critical source areas, I think you people have got copies of, describes yards as being a critical source area, got photos of them, saying that the way to mitigate this is to use a grass filter. The first sentence of clause 8E is simply deleted, or whether there's a cross reference to the certifier considering and controlling these as a matter of critical source areas, I think. Basically, somewhere within there is the solution for that one. Just going to my closing submissions, I won't recognise my way through them all by any means here. My main concern remains this duplication between certification and consenting. Certification, as I read it, is the process is resource consent, bespoke resource consent, going through exactly the same sort of assessment of environmental effects as the schedule of the IMA requires. The certifier is under the full control of council, needs to be trusted in the same way as a consent officer is trusted, and I think that's fundamentally where I get the feeling amongst the appellants that there's perhaps a lack of trust currently within the role of the certifier, but the schedule to the farm plan regulations make it quite clear that certifiers are under full control of the council. So I just, with my ear to the ground, think going through this certification process, Schedules C and D1 or D2. It's a very comprehensive thing that farmers are finding quite challenging. To then add an extra layer of requiring consent, I'm even hearing from very, very reasonable people that this is all a step too far. So I worry about the implementation of it as it's struck. Council, I think, is really going to struggle, and certainly in their engagement process in the catchment group that I coordinate, there's a lot of concern coming from those farmers, and those farmers are the ones who are more engaged, because almost all have done their own voluntary farm plan already. And then, of course, there were others who I couldn't persuade to come along to the day. So it is a very serious matter, my book. The other point I'd like to address is the slope rule for riparian fencing. I've tried to stay with the farming organisations by accepting the 10 degree slope business. I think where council has landed now is not a particularly helpful position, in that slopes over 10 degrees require an assessment of practicality. So that means a lot of work for the certifier to go around checking those steeper slopes. I think my way through this, I come back to my original position of saying 15 degrees if it's practical to do so. And there's a few instances where it's not practical. There's some safety issues sometimes. If it's a narrow ledge where the tractor's working along to on a 15 degree slope, particularly if it's a cross slope and there's a big drop off down to one side, maybe it would be deemed there that it's not practicable to do so. Maybe you can't just get access to the site by a tractor just because it's too steep, or there's a wetland in the way or something like that, or there may be hard rock conditions. Now, put all those possibilities together comes to a very few circumstances. So my preference is to say stop exclusion to up to 15 degree slope where practicable, and where it's not, the certifier has to certify it through the farm plan. Now, another aspect of slope is, and I've banged on about this in right through the process, is that it needs to be measured in something that is relatable on ground, not something that might be easily done in a planning, in a mapping situation by GIS, but I think now with the LIDAR available, those two issues converge very much. So it's a matter of measuring slope on the footprint of the tractor, 4 metre distance of seed, on the alignment of the fence, because it can be steep elsewhere. If you can find an alignment close to the stream, and I'm saying within 10 metre margin of the stream, that is of slope less than 15 degrees, the obligation should be to fence it. So I think it's important to have a rule that is able to be done on the ground. If then if you can't comply and require resource consent, if the rule's not working properly, it's a problem of the rule rather than the problem of the farmer. So I think it's very important to get one that relates to actual ground conditions. So, Your Honour, I'll just leave that there and happy to take questions.
Thank you. Now, questions? Commissioner? Thank you.
Good morning, Mel, and thank you for your submissions. Again, very helpful. In terms of the fencing issue, recognising that there will be a whole lot of things that farmers are expected to do, do you see any benefit in considering, say, doing up to 10-degree slopes as a priority and then followed by 15-degree slopes? Is there any comment you'd like to make on that kind of approach?
Yeah, yes. I think in terms of priority, it would be good to have that two-stage approach. In terms of learning, I think it's very important too, so that the tougher the territory gets, the more problems and curveballs come at you in terms of stop flow, because we've seen this change where cattle move around in the paddock. Of course, cattle want to move on the contour. That's why we all see cattle tracks on the contour everywhere. Start putting fences up across the contour. The whole cattle flow changes, and by doing some of the easier fencing first, farmers get a feel for the impact of what they've done and learn and can make more appropriate choices as they push back into steeper country.
Okay, thank you. And one second question. I know that at the hearing before I made a number of inquiries about critical source areas, and I've looked at the various definitions that have been proposed, and while I'm aware that planners speak that they understand, I'm a very firm believer in saying things in a way that mere mortals like me understand. And I just wonder whether the reference to the document that you've referred to would be helpful or not. Because when I saw that document, I thought this actually explains what we're talking about as a picture. Would you see any advantage in some reference to that in the definition or not?
Yeah, definitely. It's a puzzle too. I still always see what a critical source area is and what it isn't, and picture tells a thousand words, and that's most helpful.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. I think we'll move now to Horticulture New Zealand. Mr. Mitchell on the line.
Yes, thank you, sir. Can
you
see and hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
I take it that if you want me to deal with anything, I have to say in one touch rather than...
That's the way we seem to be going, and it seems to be working reasonably well for us.
Yes, and I don't intend to ruin the flow. I only had a small number of comments to make about the other party's submissions, and it's strictly limited to making sure the record is set straight as to what 14Z has said or is seeking. And then in terms of the council's reply, I did just have a small number of brief points as well. In terms of making sure that the court accurately understands Hort's position, there was one matter that Fish and Game raised in their very first paragraph of closing, where they've assumed to understand that Hort's preference for a case-by-case management approach is born of frustration, is what I read. And I just hope the court will immediately appreciate that's not the case at all. It's born of grower-led understanding of their own farm and the effects on the environment that activity can have. and it's thought that says that's the best way of managing the effects appropriately. That's why the case-by-case, farm-by-farm, FEP-centred approach is promoted by Hawke rather than what Malin and Friend's submissions would have you believe. I'd also say, in the case of the Fonterra and Dairy submissions at 5.3, there's an assumption or an assertion, I guess, that there could be a concentration of CVP in a subcatchment, and that could lead to degradation at that subcatchment scale. And the evidence and support was a footnote, I think, 62, to one council witness, Mr. Broxop, who I just again hope the court will immediately observe, wasn't the water quality scientist for the council, and the unchallenged, well, water quality evidence from the duly qualified people for Hawke was that there wouldn't be those effects at the subcatchment scale, and that's reflected in the joint witness statement. And the only other clarification type point from the party's submissions is from the Director General, who at 49 of their closing in relation to setbacks respectfully mischaracterises 14Z's reason for objecting to the mandatory 10 metre setback proposal. The way the Director General seems to have understood it is that growers say that there are difficulties in managing the velocity of channeling water, and the Director General then says, well, that shouldn't be a reason to not manage it, that should be an even more reason to manage it. But with respect, that's not quite right in terms of the understanding of the point about channelised flow. The point that emerged in the evidence about that was that those setbacks aren't effective in managing the effects when there is channelised flow, which for CVP there often is. And that was the justification for growers saying, well, let us choose the most appropriate mitigation or mitigations on our particular farm. So that was what I wanted to say about the other parties, and I hope I've appropriately limited myself to clarifying rather than a Novak Djokovic-style round of tennis. In terms of the council's reply or sort of final comments or submissions, I do have a few points, but if I had to boil it down to one overarching theme, the theme would be that given that it has emerged that reasonable minds differ on the proper interpretation or meaning of the PC1 provisions, it would be prudent and good drafting to make the implied express and to make the ambiguous unambiguous. That's the overarching notion that I wish to convey to the court in my comments this afternoon. I guess there are some specific examples where it seemed to me we're in a slightly odd situation, having read the council's submissions. They've basically ignored or rejected all of ORTMZ's suggestions for how you could better articulate what we all think the council's getting at, on the ground that it's obvious that was always intended. An example is at 6.9 and 6.10. Another one is at 6.22. And the final one is at 6.27D. My client was heartened to read those three instances where the council now urges, in final written comments, that's what it meant all along. And if that's the case, then I say, well, there's just no harm in, like I say, making the implied express. There was one change that the council did make in the most current version, and this is covered in their submissions at 6.26. where they have to expand the way that crop rotation is described so that it expressly refers to the fallow period. And that's welcomed, but the court would hopefully have seen it in our submissions that a preferable way of describing it would be to also mention fallow land, but also to mention cover crops and that sort of activity, that because that's all part of it, and that's in our closing at paragraph 36. And similarly, there's a few other items in my list of other relief they're seeking where the council has resisted and said, well, they've got their reasons, and I've expressed ours in closing, so I won't go through those. But one that I should really mention is at 6.28 and 2.9, this is the question of whether to say anything and what to track about the drinking water standards. Happily, Hawkins Zealand agrees entirely with the council's submission that, contrary to the request by dairy interests, there shouldn't be a singling out of CVP with respect to drinking water standards having to be or exceedances having to be avoided. And instead, I think the council said, well, the wording could sufficiently just say that measures to address any adverse effects on downstream drinking water. Hawkins Zealand supports that, and the only other way of tackling it that I would have thought of, as opposed to the reasons my learned friend from the council gave, was going back to the basis and the evidence given by the dairy sector for this drinking water standards wording. And if you'll remember, or maybe I remember, that it comes from, I think it was Dr. Dupree, or perhaps Mr. Willis, who was asked right at the outset of his evidence by Commissioner Hodges whether the way it had been phrased was concerning, given that it was just meant to be a consideration rather than a prohibition. And at the notes of evidence, page 1120, it was Mr. Willis, freely says, yes, it's a good point. I've reflected on it. This is expressed as a sort of prohibition, and it may be more appropriate to express it as a consideration. And he says he's happy to think more about that. And my submission in light of that is, while I appreciate my learned friend the dairy interests' quite honest attempt to rewrite that part of the provision, with respect, I think it hasn't successfully done so, because it's sort of retained the flavour of a prohibition by using the language of avoidance. And so, though it's elegantly drafted, I do think that the council's attempt is a better one, given that what we're trying to achieve is make sure it's a consideration, not a prohibition. And finally, in terms of offsetting and compensation, the council, section 7 of their submissions, addresses this, and in short, Horticulture NZ continues to prefer the wording proposed by the iwi of Hauraki and others. I submit the council's rewording to remove references to those perhaps ambiguous phrases, offset and compensation, is certainly an improvement. But I see they've included this notion of having to, if you have an increased risk in one place, you have to reduce it in another place. And the only thing that concerns me about that for my clients is I can just imagine many situations where you'd be reducing risks to other contaminants at the same location. So I didn't quite understand why what the merit was in the council wording talking about this alternative location, whereas when you go back to the iwi of Hauraki's way of wording it, I submit it does a better job of implementing what I think has been intended with that offsetting and compensation policy. So that was all I wanted to say, unless the court had any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Todd. Mr. Hopkins.
Good afternoon,
myself. Just a couple of points of clarification, please.
Yes.
Is there somewhere in your evidence where you've actually proposed specific provisions? I apologise for asking that, but there's a lot of evidence that I'm trying to keep in my head.
Not subsequent to the giving of evidence or the hearing of our witnesses, no. So obviously we've got planning evidence, which and there's the joint witness statement of planners, but after that it's no. Instead, in our submissions we've said, you know, here's what we would prefer, but we haven't done a red line version. No.
Okay, thank you. And just one other point relating to offsetting and compensation. My understanding is that provision was included by the decision makers, the council decision makers, to provide for commercial vegetable growing to expand in some way. Is that your understanding?
Yes, I did read that, and I have no reason to doubt it, no.
Okay, well, I then went to your appeal and saw that you wanted that provision removed, but now you're supporting it, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Just wanted to clarify. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Medjitol. Move next in terms of the order. Is the Waikato River Authority present before the court today? No? Turn then to Mr. Ferguson and the joint closing statement for River Iwi and Hauraki. And
CNI. Thank you, sir. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Just in relation to that document, it was thought by the three parties, having discussed the matter, that given we came at the end, there was no utility or significant utility in making substantive submissions, but rather there's been a focus in recent times of trying to align and coordinate the positions of the three human parties as they were presented somewhat disparately at the hearing, and so that's the purpose of the document.
Thank you.
It doesn't really add substantive new matters. There are some slight nuances which are set out in the appendix, and you'll see in particular of note that CNI is supportive of a restricted discretionary activity status rather than a discretionary activity status for a new rule for tangata ancestral land, whereas the River Iwi are still in a somewhat more conservative position of a discretionary activity rule.
Yes.
That reflects, I think, the starting point for those parties in that respect. One of the matters that's of particular importance, just to emphasise, given that reference has been made today to Policy 5 and the offsetting provisions, is that while Iwi of Hauraki, I think I'm substituting for Mr. Maguire for present purposes, and I'm not sure he's present today, have proposed a rewrite of that, which the River Iwi and CNI don't support. The three parties are at one on the importance of Policy 5 being expressly subject to Policy 17.
Right.
As that issue of the creation of headroom collectively across relevant sub-catchments, which is what Policy 17 now deals with, is obviously a different approach to the within property offsetting mitigation that Policy 5 reflects. So that's an important issue. There have been further discussions between my two clients, River Iwi and CNI, in order to also try and align those so that the court has a comparative position or a common position, and it's largely, I think, almost with the exception of that tungsteno ancestral land rule. I think we are now completely aligned, even though the CNI appeal is on a narrow range of issues. I have a document that confirms that and sets that out in hopefully a summary way for the court as well, which pulls that all together into a single document for those two parties. So virtually I'll provide that again. It's not intended to make additional submissions, but rather provide a single reference point for the drafting comments that have been made through the submissions already made. I think in relation to additional matters arising and reflecting on the various points that have been commented on by the council, the regional council that is, and other parties today, I think there are five points I'd just like to make. The first is in relation to the potential of an alternative drafting gate using the nitrogen risk scorecard. The position, I can't speak for the area of Hauraki, but the position for the river area and CNI is that they are neutral and not uncomfortable with there being a dual or an alternative gateway, providing there's a drafting gateway into the rules only. Obviously, both parties had concerns regarding overseer or an overstretch in relation to overseer, so touching on the point raised by Commissioner Hodges earlier today about potentially going through a gateway using an ice cream scorecard, but then later assessing whether there'd been a reduction in risk, I think, or through using overseer is a point that the River Avenue CNI are concerned about, and consider firmly that if one is entering the rules through one or other gateway, then that is the gateway tool that should be used for judging the line of progress. In that regard, obviously, needless to say, and I think it's often we're slipping, and I think various parties have made comments between references to managing risk as opposed to managing consequences or actual effects, and we've got a fundamental challenge in that regard due to limitations of overseer, which can deal with risk analysis but not necessarily actual effect consequences, and the absence of the development of a freshwater accounting system or some modified or new model or methodology that will allow those matters to be properly assessed in terms of improvement in actual effects. And it's obviously a fundamental and critical matter going forward. And so that was the second point, moving on from overseer and the risk scorecard, was to be clear about re-emphasising the importance of the establishment of that system, and in the interim of data being collected that will supply and support such a system once it is up and running, including potential future allocation methodologies. In that regard, I think both Dr. Osei and Mr. Lowe included in those supplementary speaking points they presented on the final day of the hearing a list of matters that appropriately should be recorded by way of data, and some better expressed inclusion of those within the methodology, potentially within the relevant schedules, is appropriate. I think there's also, as an additional and related point, there's also a need to close the loop so that we're not only having data being collected and recorded, and there's certainly provisions about that being required, but we also need to ensure that that data is provided to the Regional Council, either as a matter of obligation, we're provided in the rules and policies, or on the request of the Regional Council. So we can't afford to have an issue where we suddenly have new methodologies or an accounting framework, and we then have the Regional Council chasing various landowners for data that they have been compiling over a period of years. There's an ongoing ability to provide it to the Council on an interim basis, an ongoing basis, and that will place all parties in the best position to adapt to that framework and any new methodology. probably the last major point relates to, and it's been again touched on by a number of parties, but the need for certainty and clarity of provisions, and there are three aspects to that. First, and I think Judge Williams made the same point earlier to, say wherever reasonably possible, where one is referring to obligations that arise in other documents, and including it regards things such as farm regulations, the stock exclusion regulations, and even potentially the NPSFN 2020, that those substantive obligations should be set out within PC1, not relying on cross-references alone, and it's particularly important in face of the possible erosion of some of those obligations, given some of the indications of their potential reforms. Where those current frameworks have been agreed to be best practice and incorporated deliberately within PC1 and its development, but then those matters are integral to the ongoing implementation and success of PC1, and therefore we can't afford to have them eroded by potentially changing external documentation. The second point in relation again to clarity and certainty is to endorse Mr. Mitchell's points regarding making the implied express and making the ambiguous unambiguous, and I think that's a general observation. As an important matter as the court is reviewing the parties' various positions and the different drafting that has been put forward. And finally, linked to that, and again, ensuring the avoidance of unintended consequences, being quite clear how different rules and policies relate to one another, and obviously one of those is the example of making policy 5 subject to policy 17 and being express about that, but there are also other similar examples that perhaps could deal with some greater clarity in that respect. Another is the cross-reference to, I think, in policy 5, I think it is, to the methodologies in terms of the contaminants of greatest concern, where we have the removal of Table 3, Item 2, which now means we don't have that list, but the importance of Dr. Osei indicated, including within the methodology, a greater clarity around precisely what is required in terms of the goals in that respect and what are those reductions of key contaminants that are required at the very least at the sub-catchment level. And that was a matter that was identified in the joint witness statement collectively, I think, by the experts of the need to not leave that hanging, but to make sure there's a clear methodology and some direction in that respect. I think then another final point in relation to the clarity is I have some sympathy for unintended consequences such as Mr. Matheson's indicated regarding use of definitions in terms of property and single operating unit. And while trying to simplify terminology, one needs to clear that there aren't unintended consequences, and it would appear on the face of what I've seen in that regard that there may be something that we need to carefully step through in that regard. I think the final point is obviously the Riverine CMI are conscious of timeframes and delay in terms of implementation and authorisation of PC1, and so is troubled by the references to scope in Section 293 and the challenges to a number of matters, including the inclusion of the NRS as an alternative gateway in that respect, and there are also some other matters in terms of the non-confined activity rule. Obviously, without taking a firm position on those matters, if there are mechanisms, as Your Honour has indicated, there may be in the course of this morning to mitigate those delays through interim decisions and other opportunities, then the River Union CMI would strongly support that and certainly doesn't want to encourage results that are going to result in lengthy additional litigated processes or public processes that will delay implementation. So those were the only additional issues that I just wish to emphasise to those. And apologies for my voice, which is the reason I'm not there present, because I had got some kind of allergy and I didn't want to spread it.
All right. Any questions? No? No, no questions from us. Thank you very much, Mr. Ferguson. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, sir, and I'll provide that
translated
position between the referee and the CNI as well. As I say, it's for the assistance of the court rather than to kind of further advance extensive matters.
Thank you very much. Director General, Ms. Tumai, do you wish to address us in relation to your closing statement?
Yes, sir. I do have a couple of final comments.
Thank you. I think we need this.
So I do thank you, Your Honour, for the opportunity to make some further comments, and they are restricted to what I've covered in the closing submissions for the Director General. I guess the first point I wanted to touch on is the offsets and compensation. Put it simply, offsets requires measurement of the gain that's proposed for the offset and the effect from the activity. There needs to be a measured approach to ensure that a gain is actually achieved. That is the importance of an offset. And compensation is follows the same principles, but there's far not as a rigid approach to it as it is for offsets. And that explains why that is because compensation comes at the end of the effects management hierarchy, a last resort. So compensation shouldn't be looked at first, it should be offsets as per the hierarchy. However, what the Regional Council are proposing, and I accept and note from the final version that the reference to offsetting and compensation has been removed, but the ongoing concern for the Director General is with what is being proposed in Policy 5 now, how is that going to be measured? There's nothing in the plan to provide any guidance around that. The Director General's position is set out in the opening submissions that it's a form of nutrient trading. And so how do we measure that what's being proposed here in terms of overall reduction in the relevant subcatchment of the risk of this huge discharge? How do we, one of the contaminants, how is that to be measured with this approach? And any increase in the risk of this huge discharges of one or more of the contaminants is addressed by the reduction in the risk of disputes, discharges of the other contaminants. Again, how is this to be measured? There's the concern here. If there's no tool there or guidance to measure how this is to be achieved, then can we say that there has been an overall benefit, or is it going to be further degradation of the other? There's just no guidance there, and so the Director General's concerns continue and remain in relation to what's being proposed for Policy 5. And that concern comes through in terms of the point source discharges and what's being proposed there is similar. So the Director General continues to have concerns with that. The other topic or matter, just in terms of implementation methods, I think the point needs to be made that when the PCO was first notified, there was very little focus on lakes and wetlands. When you look at that notified version, there were no objectives for lakes, only for fungal muddy or wetland, not the other wetlands. And then in the policy of the notified version, the lake policy was very limited into gathering of information. But the Director General's position continues in that it needs to be the implementation method proposed, particularly 3.11.3.1, is just not robust enough to collect the extent of information necessary in the Director General's view to gather the data, the information required for future plan processes, for future decision making. The Director General's position of what's proposed in terms of an implementation method by the Council is inadequate. And it has to be pointed out that Dr. Scarsbrook accepted in questions from the Council, from myself, that the implementation should be robust. We're wanting more specificity, not just testing conditions of a wetland. There needs to be testing of the soils, other factors around wetlands, so and what's in the and the implementation currently is not adequate, so the concerns continue there for the Director General for future plan changes. The other point is on Schedule C, and I'm not going to go over what I've covered in my closings for the Director General. I guess the overarching point and observation that the Director General makes is in relation to the Director General accepts that there needs to be a buy-in from the farmers for this plan to work on the ground. We get that. And there needs to be, to an extent, levels of agreement through landowner catchment plans. It's essential in achieving Te Tiru Whaimana objectives, but there needs to be recognition that the environment cannot wait for buy-in, cannot continue to wait for agreements to be reached. It seems that it's agreements with landowners is necessary for council to take action. So in the Director General's position, is that the environment cannot wait much longer. The wetlands, black water events, lakes, risk of eutrophication, rivers and streams. I won't labour this point too much, but evidence from Ms. MacArthur talks about the Komakoro and Waita Whiriwhiri sub-catchments. Ammonia concentration shows that since PC1 target attribute states were set, concentrations of ammonia have significantly increased at these sites. Both stream sub-catchments are in the worst 25% of all lowland sites in New Zealand, with ammonia concentrations 2 to 3 times the national bottom line. Ammonia makes up a large proportion of the dissolved nitrogen at these monitoring sites, and the cause of this degradation requires urgent investigation. And so whilst, as I say, we're hearing the farming interests, there needs to be buy-in, there also needs to be recognition of the environment and the fact that it cannot wait any longer for these buy-ins, for these agreements to be reached. It's suffering. And so I just ask that the court take that, and I know the court knows what it's doing, so I just wanted to emphasise that point. I won't go into this, I'll cover the setbacks extensively in the closings, I won't go there. The only final point I want to make is in relation to commercial vegetable production. I take my friend's comment there. I guess the point I wanted to make here, the position that the Director General has here, is that we see the best practice guidelines, they're very extensive. Mr. Barber's evidence confirms as much. All we're saying is setbacks need to be in the mix there as part of that mitigation measures. It seems, based on the evidence, that the current mitigation being the sediment retention ponds is heavily reliant on the bunds and their effectiveness, they're being regularly cleaned. And failure of any of that, it seems those won't work. And some measures in conjunction with those, such as vegetation buffers, should be employed wherever possible and necessary. Those are my further comments to this.
Thank you very much. Now, we've got to 1 o'clock, and in terms of the orders I've been calling people in, I think all the parties that I remain to call on are the point source discharge parties. I see Ms. Garvin here in court, and I think I was aware that Ms. Chappell was on the line previously. Is she? No. And the others would be Mr. Muldowney or... it was Mr. Malone for the council. So, Ms. Chappell, you are there. Mr. Muldowney or Mr. Malone? I'm just wondering how long the two of you may need. Ms. Garvin, how long do you think you may need?
Your Honour, I wasn't intending to actually speak to the submissions.
All right.
I'm here as a watching brief.
Yes, were you?
Observing the questions.
I wondered if that was the case. Thank you. Ms. Chappell, how long do you think you may need? Microphone, I think. I can't hear you. No?
She may be signaling you on a 5 minutes.
Oh, 5 minutes.
You know, Ms. Chappell, if that's...
If parties are content, I'd be inclined on that basis to press on. I don't know whether you might be wanting to make any comments at all in reply. Again, we don't want to get into a back and forth, but if there was anything in particular that you wanted to address, I'd give you that opportunity.
Yes, sir, quite briefly. I think it would be useful, certainly, if I had all the tennis balls, I think we'll have to
ask. Well then, I'll invite Ms. Chappell to address us on the OG submissions. Thank you. So we still have a connection issue. We're not hearing you, Ms. Chappell. I don't know if there's a microphone issue at your end or anything else. You can hear me, I take it.
Yes.
Sometimes disconnecting and reconnecting is what you need to do, and we're happy to hang on for that if you want to give that a try. Thank you. And just while we're doing that, I'll just double check. Is there anyone else present who is expecting to have an opportunity to address us who I haven't called on? No. Very good.
Your Honour, if for no other reason than to fill the space.
Okay,
just hang on. Yeah. That's right. Well, I haven't said anything, which is quite distressing. but I thought perhaps it may be helpful. I don't know if I'm close enough to that thing. And I've just alerted my friend to it. Commissioner Hodges was referring to the Beaton Lamb appeal and submission earlier
as
a context of scope, and it would have escaped your attention. That's something I haven't engaged particularly wholesomely on. But in terms of the Beef and Lamb appeal, my friend Ms. Carruthers is correct that it doesn't address matters at all. It's very, very confined. But in the original Beef and Lamb submission, Commissioner Hodges identified one set of relief that was sought, which I think was the relief, and I just raised this so you can take a note of it if it's of any help, at page 55 of the original submission, which is reference to the use of overseer in Schedule B. But the submission also very generally, which was a habit of Beef and Lambs for a while there, saw very general relief in accordance with some nutrient management principles. And Principle 14 of that list referred to the limitations of modelling. Modelling nutrient loss, and went on to say that other measures may need to be included in the approach to managing nutrient loss to ensure innovative change is incentivised and that the focus remains on promoting good practice. And then goes on to say over time things will improve. So it's a very broad submission that's designed to capture change. And that's found at pages 13 and 14 under the chapeau, I suppose, of page 11. So to the extent that that might be helpful to other parties or the court in terms of nailing down that issue, it's very broad,
yeah.
And I'm not submitting that it anticipated the issue, but it may assist with a pathway through.
Grateful to you for those references. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Well, welcome back, Ms. Chappell. Can we hear you?
I'm hopeful, Your Honour.
Absolutely, loud and clear.
Thank you. As usual, all the coming back in that did the trick, so thank you for that. I just have a couple of very brief points that I wanted to make. And essentially, obviously the parties have undertaken quite a lot of work following on from the very helpful minute that the court issued in relation to the consul's discharge issues. And I suggest that that has really resulted in a continuing narrowing of the points of difference. And following on from the reply submissions of the council, that seems to have narrowed matters even further, certainly from OG's perspective, to the point where if we are focusing on the council's redraft, then there are really only two points of difference between OG and the council. And I've set that out at Appendix 1 of the closing submission. And that's really just the issue in relation to Objective 3. And then the second point is whether or not Policy 11 should be referring more specifically to the cross-reference in Policy 12. So other than that, it appears that those are the only two matters in disagreement. Obviously, with the Council not so much as stating that it supports the changes that OG has proposed in terms of some of the other amendments, but now stating that it is not opposed to those positions. So I'll leave it to the court to determine how it wishes to progress on that basis. Clearly, if the court intends to retain the earlier drafting, then the points of difference are in fact larger as between the parties. And so for that reason, in the closing submissions, I have set out in Appendix 2 the track changes. And that is obviously more reflective of where we got to at the point at which the Points Discharge hearing closed. So there's nothing further that I wish to address, Your Honour, subject obviously to the court having any questions for me.
Well, I suppose the only question is, given we don't appear to have appearances today from Mr. Muldowney or Mr. Malone, whether or not you've been in contact with them at all about point source discharge matters?
Yes, my understanding here is that the parties are aligned on those matters. So,
thank you.
So there is a high degree of alignment.
That's helpful. Thank you for that.
Any questions?
No? Well, thank you, Ms. Chappell. That's very clear. I'm glad we were able to hear it from you rather than receive it through sign language. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now, I'm not sure if you heard, but for those who are still present, Mr. Conway has signalled that there are a couple of things he'd like to address us in reply to reply to reply.
Thank you, Stephen. I'm conscious. As a person who is an influence on when people can have lunch, it's important to be brief, so I'll endeavour to do that.
Part of my plan.
The overall position, essentially, sir, is that I think in terms of the matters we've heard today, I'd rely on our closing submissions, which I think anticipated and dealt with those matters, so I'm not intending to reply to things, and certainly, as you'd expect, not mentioning something doesn't mean we necessarily agree with it.
No.
If I step through a few quick points. In terms of the question about that raised by Mr. Medjitov about the subcatchment scale effects of crop rotation at different scales, he referred to some evidence about from the water quality experts that there wouldn't be effects at the subcatchment scale from crop rotation. Now, that was the first part of the answer under question 49 of the water quality joint witness statement. And so when you're considering that, I would invite you also to read the second sentence, or second paragraph, which said, there is the potential for localised impacts associated with concentration of CEP in certain areas.
Yes. I can recall that coming up here in Europe itself.
Stepping back through in reverse order really through other points, in terms of Mr. Matheson's comments about dry stock yards, I appreciate now the concern that was raised was in relation to the wording in our closing submissions about whether runoff to land was being prevented by that provision, condition 80 of D, Schedule D1 Part D. Our submissions said that the provisions themselves do not, I think, raise the issue that Mr. Matheson was concerned about, so I would invite a consideration of the provision rather than necessarily that particular component, which won't be sitting there when someone's interpreting this rule later. In terms of the comments about arable farming, I've not yet had a time to fully discuss those examples with Mr. Tredulco. What I do understand, though, is that the council's intention was not to have a 20-hectare limit on arable cropping, so to the extent that was part of my answer earlier when I initially made comments on these provisions, please update the notes accordingly. But I would say that as a general point, the examples given by Mr. Matheson may well be useful examples to test the provisions, and I'd be quite comfortable for that testing to occur to the extent that's been as realistic examples. Stepping back through, in terms of some comments made by my friend Mr. Anderson from Forest and Bird, the issues around overseer and the like, and the question about whether the court can undertake a planning role, I would respectfully disagree with the suggestion that a variation is needed to carry out the changes that certainly the council's putting forward here. And to do so would not be the court undertaking a planning role in any way that's problematic. In reality, the approach of using the NREs has been proposed by the parties, including the council, and I don't claim that it's by all parties, in the course of the appeal process. It's not a suggestion, in my view, that the court would be going off on a separate track and coming up with a surprise new planning approach. The court has evidence about the pros and cons of the NRS, and it has been tested through the hearing. And the overall point on that really is that the council is looking for solutions here. And is open to the solutions that's put forward, or if the court sees a better way to do that, then it would welcome that. And it's certainly looking for ways in which those things can be implemented with the minimum of procedural challenge. And so that brings us back to the overall purpose of the plan change, which is to achieve the 2x9 and to start getting some runs on the board. The related concern Mr. Anderson expressed about not trusting the NRS and it not being tested, it is being used as a sorting tool only. I think that's generally well understood for the rule gateways. As to the request for what you described, I think, as a proper planning process so it can be assessed, there has been a full hearing process so that all parties have been free to attend and test it, and that's occurred through questions of witnesses. So in my submission, there has been a proper planning process, albeit in the de novo hearing process in front of the court. And second to last point from me, that brings us to scope in section 293. I appreciate scope matters will need to be looked through. The nature and range of scope matters that have been raised by the parties again today is another reason why the council is quite open to a focused Section 293 process in terms of protecting this process from concerns that may be raised later. And so in my submission, that is exactly what Section 293 is about, and it's an available approach that could well have a useful purpose here. We filed a memorandum on the 31st of March this year that covered Section 293, and there are some points in that that I just want to come back to briefly.
We still have that. I mean, you can cross-refer to it. I do recall that, and my recollection was that at that stage the court felt that it was we didn't want to preempt the hearing process. But I fully understand, I don't have it in front of me right now, but I expect that when I go back to it, I will see that the points that are being made there will be directly applicable to any consideration we need to give to it in our deliberations.
Thank you, sir. The cross-references are to paragraphs 23, 26 and 27 in that memorandum.
Thank you very much.
I will just touch on the one point, and out of there, in 23 we quote from the Invocator Leopold case, and it says in paragraph 32 of that case, while the power conferred upon the Environment Court under Section 293 of the Act may appear to be very broad, the relief sought must relate to the subject matter of the proposed plan. There must be a nexus or a rational connection between the appeal itself and the change relief sought.
Which paragraph is that?
That's paragraph 23 of our memorandum,
yes.
And paragraph 32 of the Invocator
of the Invocator Airport decision.
Yes.
Thank you.
And so, in my submission, those matters illustrate why it's an available option here. Yeah. The final matter that I wish to go back to is the point I raised in opening, that the Regional Council was very grateful for the constructive input that has been provided through the plan preparation process and in relation to the appeals. And the council has sought at all stages to put forward genuine improvements to the plan in order to make it workable and in order to make it effective. It's quite aware that the court is likely to identify further improvements, and the council is of course open to that. And if there's any further assistance the council can provide, then it's very happy to provide that assistance. And, those are the only matters I wish to raise in closing. I'm grateful for the opportunity to do so.
Thank you. Well, I would like to thank everybody who's attended today and all those who have provided us with their closings. I'm very grateful, again, for the focus that people have brought to the process and the direct approach that's been taken. I don't think that there's any contest about the idea of picking up on what others have said to us earlier today. We need to be clear about what we are saying and to deal with things in an unambiguous way. We're going to adjourn the matter now, and we'll have a preliminary consideration about what more we need to do. In particular, we're going to have a discussion about whether we need to undertake a site visit before we might proceed with an interim decision. And we will let you know about our plans in relation to that. As I say, the possibility of us doing a site visit in the next 2 weeks is nil, and we'll consider whether or not it will be feasible in the very early part of next year. We won't close the hearing until we've made a determination about how we'll proceed with the site visit, because ordinarily the site visit is a matter that may have a bearing on what we do next and the evidential process generally. All things coming in, we will make a formal decision in terms of closing of the hearing. if there is, well, there's the further study that's being done, and we'll be receiving material in relation to that, and as indicated, any comments, any reporting, any interpretation which accompanies that, we will issue directions to enable parties to make comment on that if they wish to do so. If there are any further matters that arise, without it being sort of bright ideas that occur to you on the staircase as you leave the hearing, then the usual approach would be to make an application through the registrar, because at this stage we regard cases as having been closed, but we are aware that there may yet be certain things that arise. As I say, we've got this further study that occurs. If anything occurs to us where we think we need anything further before we formally close the hearing, we'll come back to the parties with directions as to a process for that, and if need be, if we think there are procedural issues, an opportunity for those procedural issues to be addressed. Is there anything else that anybody can think of that ought to be addressed at this stage before we adjourn? No? Very good. Once again, thank you all very much. Best wishes. I hope that everybody is able to take a reasonable break at the end of this year, and I wish the best to all of you for the holiday season and for the new year. Thank you very much.